And what's interesting is that even at that point, not all the political nation was even willing to go that far. Some people weren't even willing to try and use any kind of coercion against the monarch. But it doesn't really matter what ultimately might have been, because what seems to have happened at this point is that James lost his nerve. Had he attacked William with his army, he had a large army, there might never have been what came to be called the Glorious Revolution. But James didn't do that. He, like I said, he seems to have lost his nerve. He ordered a retreat to London, and in December of 1688, James left England altogether and took up residence in France. Events then moved fairly quickly in England itself. In January of 1689, after an awful lot of anguished soul-searching, Parliament decided to offer the throne to James II's daughter Mary and her husband William of Orange. This decision was fairly easy for the Whigs. They had for some time now embraced a notion of popular sovereignty. There was a sense of a contractual relationship between the monarchy and the people. It was relatively easy for them to argue that the monarchy had violated his covenant with the people and therefore was no longer a proper monarch. It was an awful lot harder for the Tories, who were these royal legitimists, to accept the fact that they had gotten rid of one monarch and brought on a new one. In the end, the Tories seem to have settled on an odd hodgepodge of theories, including, number one, the so-called warming pan baby theory, which was that James's wife hadn't really given birth to a son, but they had sneaked in a baby that wasn't really hers into the royal birthing room, hidden in a warming pan. There were other theories that, well, James seems to have resigned the job by running away to France, so we have to give it to somebody. It was embarrassing, fairly clearly, for the Tories. In the end, it's pretty clear for most people, and for most Tories at least, that they opted for whatever monarch there was who could at least provide the security of private property. As for James II himself, he went to France, he gained the support of Louis XIV, his Catholic co-religionist, and promptly returned in 1689 to Ireland, where he hoped to create a base to recapture his throne in England. Again, the Catholic Irish rose up, and again they fairly quickly gained control of most of the island. But unfortunately for James, he was defeated by William's forces at the Battle of the Boyne in 1690, and in the year 1691, Under the Treaty of Limerick, the Irish rebels made peace, in exchange for which they got a fairly generous settlement, limited religious toleration for Catholics, and protection for the remaining property of Catholic landowners. That's at least the terms under which they surrendered. The English Parliament would have none of that. It promptly threw out the Treaty of Limerick, and another round of land expropriation followed. Renewed penal laws were passed, excluding Catholics from all positions of power, and subsequent parliamentary enactments went even further, deliberately seeking to hobble commerce and industry in Ireland, prevent competition with England, and turn Ireland into a backward agrarian colony of its more powerful English neighbor. As for James II, he would spend the rest of his life in exile as a pensionary of Louis XIV of France. He died in 1701 and never regained his throne. In England, which is the main focus of this lecture, only limited changes would actually be made to the Constitution. Perhaps the most important of these changes was the Bill of Rights of 1689, which henceforth forbade the Crown to suspend parliamentary statutes and to levy taxes or maintain a standing army in peacetime without the express consent of Parliament. Another act of the same year, the Toleration Act of 1689, allowed rights of legal worship to all Protestants who would take an oath of supremacy, that is to say, an oath acknowledging the Crown's control of the Church, and an oath of allegiance to the Crown itself. That is to say, the Toleration Act, in effect, extended civil rights to dissenters, to non-Anglican Protestants. Catholics, on the other hand, would have to wait until the early 19th century before they received any civil rights in England. But to go back to the 17th century, two more pieces of legislation are probably significant here. One of these is the so-called Triennial Act of 1694, which required that a parliament would have to now meet every 3 years, so that parliament, the summoning of parliament was now no longer a matter purely of the king's whim, but would automatically follow every 3 years unless they were summoned more frequently by the crown. And finally, the Act of Settlement of 1701 formally prohibited any Catholic from succeeding to the English throne, and it's perhaps worth noting that this act is still in place. If any member of the British royal family converts to Catholicism, they're automatically excluded from succession to the throne. Now, these acts, the Bill of Rights, the Toleration Act, the Triennial Act, the Act of Settlement, they're very important, and they have a very prominent place in most textbooks of English constitutional history. But in terms of actual practical politics, I think it has to be stressed that they imposed only meager limitations on the power of the monarchy. Indeed, in many ways, I think most historians would argue, the later Stuarts, That is to say, Mary, who died in 1694, followed by her husband William in 1702, and Queen Anne, who died in 1714, were actually, and somewhat ironically, much more powerful than James I and Charles I had ever been.